you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Michael Hoffman on the show. Mike Hoffman is an independent scholar and author of many books, including The Occult Renaissance, Church of Rome, Judaism's Strange Gods, Usury in Christendom, The Mortal Sin That Was and Now, and Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare. He is a former reporter for the New York Bureau of the Associated Press. He is the editor of Revisionist History of the Revisionist History newsletter, and his primary website is revisionisthistory.org. Tonight, I have him on to discuss his book, Adolf Hitler, Enemy of the German People. Mr. Hoffman, how are you doing this evening?
Very well, thank you.
Is there anything you want to add to that, or does that kind of cover it?
That covers it.
Okay. Well, you've written this book. I think it was released last fall, and sort of revised the revisionist view of Hitler. There's a lot of different interpretations of that era of the Third Reich and Hitler. And you posit that Hitler was an unprecedented disaster for the German people and for the German state. And he brought down a catastrophe on the German people and in fact, the entire world with his leadership of Germany for those 12 years. And you describe him as sort of an occultist leader, tool of the cryptocracy. I know this runs counter to a lot of revisionist history now. A lot of people are looking at Hitler as a guide or looking to revise the history, said he's been unduly demonized and that history is misunderstood, a lot of propaganda, which is true in many respects, but your book offers a clarification of that. So I'll let you go from there.
Well, I mean, demonization of a demon is rather difficult. Of course, he was a human being, and if he were alive today, I would be praying for him. But you have a fellow who, almost from the onset of his career, beginning in 1919, was immersed in the occult. We know that, for example, in April 1919, which is sometimes considered the lost years to biographers, that in Munich, he was part of the communist government there. It's a very strange episode in his life. It hasn't been accounted for to any degree by revisionists. And then by early May, when he saw which way the wind was blowing, he flipped over to the reconstituted Bavarian government, which was a conservative government, largely military run. And this was under the direction of the Thule Society, T-H-U-L-E, which was basically the occult provenance behind Adolf Hitler. Now, the typical response to that datum is that Hitler closed the Masonic lodges. He was the enemy of the Judaic occultism. And that's like saying that Ford Motor Company put Chevrolet out of business and therefore Ford is no longer interested in selling cars. These other groups were rivals of his particular occultism, and we can talk about that later, about the racial soul and how this emanated from some of the initiation that Dietrich Eckart, who is a moving force inside the Thule Society, and Hitler's guide almost from the beginning of his career. And I'll let you interrupt there, or however you want to take this search for the truth.
When you say the tool of the cryptocracy, what is the cryptocracy?
Well, I mean, literally, it just means rule by a secret cabal. But the cryptocracy, as has been largely known in the right wing, or at least the anti-Zionist right wing, is always made to be synonymous with Judaic people and Judaism. And when I was researching the book that you mentioned, Usury in Christendom, The Mortal Sin That Was and Now Is Not, I had been a student of Ezra Pound when it came to the usury question, as well as Thomas Aquinas and others. But I was quite surprised when I did the primary research to discover that long before the time from which Ezra Pound establishes the beginning of usury banking, which is in Protestant London, England, and the onus of usury is placed on Protestantism, that actually I discovered that it was part of the nominalist Catholic theology, which then gave birth to Johannes Eck, who was the theological nemesis, as you know, of Martin Luther, but also the theological advocate for the usury of the Fugger banking dynasty, the wealthiest people on earth at that time, who were actually part of collecting the indulgences. Their agents were holding the money that was coerced from the people for the indulgence racket. And from there, we go to the Strozzi bankiers, the infamous Medici and others, and we discover that long before the Rothschilds were anything other than rag pickers and fur merchants, we see that the largely usury banking was in the hand of Gentiles, was in the hand of a goy cryptocracy that was scapegoating the Judaics, who were a very minor force at that time. And I find that the same phenomenon is at work here in the history of World War II, where Adolf Hitler is posited as being independent of the cryptocracy when he was actually working for one branch of it. Did he do so consciously? Well, that would be a question that someone else would answer. I tend to think that in his megalomania, he thought that he was sui generis and that he was a phenomenon that had no other parallel. But certainly when we look at the career of Dietrich Eckhart, his familiarity with the Kabbalistic Chokhmah or world spirit, and we begin to see the outlines of Hitler's magical thinking that led him to so many disasters. People tend to emphasize his rebuilding of the economy in Germany, which, by the way, was done with cooperation of so-called Aryan, I put that word in quotes, Aryan banks. Yes, he drove Judaic banks out of business, but he relied on Aryan usurers and so-called Aryan industrialists for that economic miracle, which, by the way, was predicated on the building of a war machine and with the intent of making war in the East against the Slavic people. So it isn't quite the economic miracle that has been presented to us. But then once the war begins and we see this magical thinking in effect, particularly with the invasion of the Soviet Union, that's when I see the hallmarks of his magical training. And I will add here, Mr. Kelly, that the two leading attributes of the Kabbalistic praxis is self-worship and the creation of a human and subhuman dichotomy. So what we have is that Adolf Hitler substituted for the worship of Jesus Christ, which the German people have been largely engaged in since Christianity first came to the Teutonic people, for the worship of the German people. And then, of course, he created Kabbalistically the Aryan Superman, the Übermensch, and then the subhuman Slavs and Judaics. Those are classical Kabbalistic hallmarks, and they're certainly present in Hitler's Gestalt and Weltanschauung.
Now, some have posited that Hitler was sort of conjured up by the cryptocracy or the Anglo-American Zio Empire. A while back, I interviewed a gentleman, Guido Preparato, who wrote a book, Conjuring Hitler, How Britain and America Made the Third Reich. And he said, at least he posits in his book, that he looks at the two world wars as sort of a 30 years war, an attempt by the Anglophile world, the sea power, if you will, to gain control of the continent, the land power. This goes back to the Mackinder Doctrine. And it was their strategy to sort of manipulate the political situation in Germany so a leader like Hitler would come to power. And as you say, this doesn't necessarily mean that Hitler was a witting agent of British or Anglo-Zio or American power, but he served their purposes. And you make that claim in the book where it was the Kratocracy's agenda that Hitler helped fulfill by sort of playing out this drama.
Well, what was the denouement of the reign of Hitler? What was the end result? Germany in ashes. Mm-hmm. And the Hitler pleaders say that it was inevitable, that because he put the Germans on the rise, that it was inevitable this would happen. Even Patrick J. Buchanan, in his book on The Unnecessary War, Churchill and Hitler, objects to that thesis, that it was unnecessary and Germany did not have to be destroyed and Hitler did not have to take the moves that he did. And in particular, the move in invading the Soviet Union, which had no hope of winning whatsoever. Now, I'm well aware of the Suvorov thesis and also Joachim Hoffman's book and so forth. But even given that idea that the Soviets were about to imminently invade, and that's always the alibi for the worst military blunder that Hitler committed, that he had to respond in that way. Personally, I find that highly questionable when we look at the history, both from Napoleon and from the point of view of military strategy of great German military strategists such as von Clausewitz, that you have to factor in geography here. The Osttier, the German army in the east, had to march 1,000 miles across the Russian steppes, and they were doing it in June, and then they ended up doing it, as you know, famously in the wintertime. And they were completely ill-prepared for this. And I can go into that as a symptom of Hitler's magical thinking that he got from the book by Schertl, Magic in Theory and Practice. But what we have is, had Hitler only entered into Russia 200 or 300 miles, he could have created another wall, and I believe an impregnable wall, against any type of Soviet invasion. He did not have to have this grandiose notion that he was going to be able to take Moscow or Stalingrad or the oil fields, which was completely out of the question with the kind of preparation and material support that Hitler had allowed for the Osttier. Secondly, if Russia had invaded Germany, they would have had to come across that 1,000 miles of virtual wilderness, roadless wilderness. It was largely still Tsarist Russia at that time. And then they would have suffered what the German army suffered in terms of very poor supply lines. In fact, more so because they didn't have the organizational ability of the Germans at that time. And I think that that would have foreordained Stalin's defeat. So the whole notion that because of the Suvorov thesis, and Suvorov, that's not his real name, he's actually an agent of British intelligence, but that's the alibi for why Hitler had to undertake this Masada-like operation, the suicide operation in the East, which he was informed by his quartermaster general as early as December 1941 had caused him to lose the war. So I just see it as a debacle of epic proportions. I'm not familiar with the thesis of the gentleman that was on your program, but I can certainly see that the destruction of Germany was in the cards, and had Hitler never lived and had some type of peaceful Republican type of Christian Catholic leader, or even a non-Catholic Christian leader, had come to the fore in Germany who was wise and moderate, I believe that the Germans could have done it much better. And I don't think that that country would have been in flames and now bearing the mark of Cain for all generations as a result of the animus against Germans and much overheated Allied propaganda concerning German atrocities, which certainly were real, but they've been grossly exaggerated, as you probably know.
Yeah, atrocities on all sides, exaggerated on one side and covered up on the other, to support the narrative of the good war, which again supports today's imperium, today's Anglo-Zio imperium, Anglo-American Zio imperium. Stepping back a bit, Hitler, the politician, people think of Hitler as a dictator, but he wormed his way into power through legitimate means. He was appointed by President Hindenburg, Paul von Hindenburg. His party had gained at least a plurality in the Reichstag. Understand it was on the decline, so it was kind of this critical moment, but he was able to, I guess, by hook or by crook, get appointed. There's some evidence of of bribery or blackmail being involved in this with Hindenburg's son, I believe. I've read about that. But in gaining power, he made certain promises, and he sort of posed as a populist. And you mentioned this one, these two people by his side. One was Gregor Strasser, who I believe was murdered on the night of the Long Knives, and then Zosa Gottfried Fedor. And also Hitler courted Catholics, and also sort of posed as the anti-banker, because working with Gottfried Fedor actually had a plan that did challenge usurious bankers, both Jewish and Gentile. Correct?
Absolutely. And now I'm not correcting your pronunciation because my German isn't very good, but it may be Fader.
Okay. Sorry.
But anyhow, whichever. The point is that Fader was actually the de facto ruler of the NSDAP, the Nazi Party, in the 1920s, in that he had written the party platform, and much of the popularity and attraction to the German people was on his 100% absolutist objective of wiping out the renting of money at any rate of interest, which is back actually the rehabilitation of the medieval Catholic Church irreformable, infallible doctrine concerning this subject. So it was a wonderful thing to behold. The Germans intuited that, and much of the support for the Nazi Party came on the basis of that anti-usury platform. Strasser, meanwhile, Gregor Strasser, as opposed to his brother, Otto, although in the early 20s, Otto and Gregor were working together, but they're two different individuals who took two fairly divergent views, both on the NSDAP and on other matters. So it's with Gregor I'm concerned. And Gregor was the great organizer, particularly in North Germany. Much of the power of the Nazi Party would have been vitiated hadn't been for Gregor's organizational skills. He was a very benevolent person, had fought honorably, as many National Socialist activists did, including Adolf Hitler in World War I. And Strasser was a much admired, fine organizer. And between Fader and Strasser and other allies that they had, the NSDAP was moving ahead with keeping their commitment to crushing the banks, be they Judaic or non-Judaic, in Germany. And of course, Strasser had a struggle with Hitler on this issue. He felt that Hitler was betraying the great struggle on the great Kampf against interest and against the money power. And that's when he resigned from the party. Hitler would have liked to have kept him under his thumb, but kept him because he was such a fantastic organizer. And then his murder was arranged in cold blood. Now, there's a couple of sources on this. Goebbels lied and said that Strasser was plotting Hitler's downfall. And also, unfortunately, General de Grelle, he wrote a silly book called Hitler Democrat. He wasn't there. It wasn't based on primary sources. He was himself an idolizer of Adolf Hitler. It's not a reliable book, but I've had people tell me, and it's absurd, of course, to suggest that Hitler was a Democrat. He hated democracy, and the Nazi Party never, Adolf Hitler never received a majority of votes from the German people. Even Peterson, the psychologist, has put that myth forward, and it's simply not true. So, yes, we can see where there was a betrayal there, and I think that I use the Night of the Long Knives. Now, people like Ernst Röhm was a plotter. He definitely was attempting to overthrow Hitler. But you see how they mix apples and oranges. So you take an innocent guy like Strasser, you put him in with Röhm, and then there's guilt by association. It's the same thing that's done today in this hate speech campaign, where they'll actually take some hateful treatise by some semi-literate Klansman and ban that, and at the same time they'll ban a book by you or me, and then the connection by guilt by association is supposed to justify what is in fact the suppression of legitimate history. And so by mixing into the mass murder that Hitler perpetrated, and it was in the hundreds, that was one way of justifying this. But it's an indication of the gangsterism. I hesitate to use that word because a lot of anti-Hitler hysterics have employed purple prose like that, but it actually does fit. This is a mafia-type rub-out of a great man. Fader was internally exiled once Hitler came to power, and he died of a broken heart in the early 1940s, having seen his life's mission crushed. I'm sure he was bitterly regretful that he had ever embraced Hitler in the early days. But again, that was a push from the Thule Society, beginning as early as the Thule Society was founded in 1918. But as early as 1919, Hitler had sponsorship, and he was an absolute nobody in early 1919, and he was heavily sponsored by the Thule connected military forces. In fact, the notion that he was a spy on left-wing groups, he wasn't actually a spy. He was in the propaganda department, the information department. He'd been sponsored from the beginning by the occult Thule Society.
Yeah, in the book that I cited, Preparata's book, he also points out that the in the 1920s, the Great Inflation, and then also the Great Crash in early 30s, the people that were most affected by that were the middle class, and the elite did very well. And it was when after it, it was almost like the banks, the rug was pulled out of the Credit-Anstalt Bank and the banking system in Germany. The moment Hitler came into power, money started flowing in again to fire up the economy, and as you cite, to build the war machine. And as you point out, by making the deal, this I think this speaks to the, maybe this explains the why Strasser was murdered and Feder was purged, because in order to finance the building up the German army, the Wehrmacht, the Luftwaffe, Hitler's war machine, if you will, Hitler had to make a deal with the industrialists and the bankers. But the moment you do that, you make a pact with the devil, because then you have to work with the usurious banking system, which undermines whatever populist agenda you may have once considered. And would it be fair to say that there was at one point the National Socialists were a genuine populist party dealing with the turmoil, the problems of the day, great inflation, economic turmoil brought about by the war, and the reparation systems and things like that. But as Hitler got closer to power, he realized he had to make that deal with the devil in order to ascend to power. So was it just a dirty deal made, typical dirty politics in many ways, that brought about the Night of the Long Knives?
I would tend to say no, because of that occult element, because of this guidance that he had been receiving. Why did they pick him out like this? Yes, he had oratorical skills. Yes, he had a fine military record in World War I. There were many hundreds and thousands of out-of-work, unemployed German soldiers who fit that profile. How did they psychologically and spiritually profile Adolf Hitler to fit the template that they wanted? And the fact that he had been dictatorially oriented from the beginning, I can give you some of the information that from the beginning he said he would be the dictator of Germany. What he was a secular messiah. That's what he was setting himself up as. One thing I would dissent from is the idea that without usury banking and without a certain type of exploitative corporative industrial structure, that you can't rebuild your army or can't rebuild your nation. And what I would say is that a traditionally Catholic, that is to say, medieval economic system, has not been in power for several hundred years. And therefore, we don't really know what that would look like. But since God would be behind it, because that is his will expressed in everything from Psalm 15 to the theology of Thomas Aquinas, we would say, in looking back at the Gothic cathedrals and the enormous building projects that were successfully done in a largely interest-free economy, even though, of course, there were violations of that. Dante makes reference to the city in southern France in his Canto 11 in the Inferno as being a source associated with both banking and sodomy, which is a usury and sodomy, which is an interesting connection. But so did Hitler more or less sort of just fall into this, and that he was maybe not the most moral person and this was an economic necessity? I don't think so, because if you take a look at the sponsorship that he received, let's go to Munich University in June 1919. Who put him there? It was arranged by the Weichsar Information Department of the Bavarian government through Captain Karl Mayer, M-A-Y-R, who was a protege of the Thule Society's Dietrich Eckart. Mayer had played a significant role in the coordination of military activities of the Thule. And here they are from the beginning, bringing Hitler up. And Hitler has this idea about dictatorship from the early part of his rise inside the National Socialist Party. He said, and he told in an interview with the Daily Mail, and this is not disputed, the Daily Mail on October 2nd of 1923, he drew a significant parallel with Mussolini. He said, quote, if a German Mussolini is given to Germany, people would fall down on their knees and worship more than Mussolini has ever been worshipped. 12 days later, at a party meeting in Nuremberg, Hitler stated, quote, a real dictator does not depend on anyone. The nation depends on him, not relying on anyone else, but only on my immense resolve, and with it and through it, either gaining victory or going down to defeat. And September 14th, 1930, he says, at a moment of crisis, nations should always look to dictatorship and never to Germany. I would say here you see a clear harbinger of what this man is going to do. I mean, here he is stating at the Nuremberg party meeting in the early 20s that it all depends on him and on his immense resolve. Here you see the megalomania, and he's predicting that they'll either gain victory through him or go down to defeat. And this, if you look at, again, and the occult mandate that he received from Schertl's book and others about this, the willpower. When, for example, when officers, and I, as a former reporter, I met many German officers, including a German general from the World War II era, and have spoken with them personally, including the general was actually stationed on the Eastern Front, and how many times they went back to tell Hitler that they not only didn't have the famous no winter clothing, but they didn't have weapons, they didn't have sufficient tanks, they didn't have food, they didn't have armaments, they didn't have repairs for the engines on the vehicles that were breaking down. And they were always told, this is a failure of your will. And they were returned empty-handed and told that as an Aryan Superman, they were to use their will and overcome. That is classical 19th century occultism as channeled through Guido von Liszt and many of the other proto-Germanic Teutonic mystics who were operating at that time and talking about the race soul, which the German Aryan possessed and the Slavic people did not. And they put Hitler on the road to taking down these supposedly inferior Slavs and then building this empire in the East. And that was really the source of the downfall of the German people.
Well, because one brings to mind, of course, Leni Riefenstahl's film, Triumph of the Will, right?
Yes, but, you know, that's legitimate. I mean, you and I, when we were in our high school sports or we're struggling with trying to pay the bills for our family or whatever, the will is necessary. You know, there's a will within the bounds of Christian resolve and the kind of character that we see very little these days among our youth that has to be inculcated by parents and the church and society as a whole. That's legitimate. But when you tell some of in my opinion, the finest army in the world at that time, the German army, the Ostheer there, the Wehrmacht, that you tell them that, no, we're not going to send you any supplies. Hitler actually bragged to the German people in the war relief speech that he gave in the fall of 1941 that the war had been won against the Soviet Union, and he was turning the manufacturing of the war economy over to ship engines rather than what the troops needed in the East. When you're doing that, you're now on the thin ice of magical thinking, and that's where Hitler was.
Yeah, one could look at Operation Barbarossa as, you know, magical thinking over rational thought, because if you just look at the scope and size of that operation, just the sheer logistics that it required, a 1,500-mile front, as opposed to the Western Front, which you're dealing with 200-300-mile fronts, where blitzkrieg could work, whereas the Russian steppes, the vast Russian vastness, and Russia could absorb huge blows and punches without collapsing. And that became clear by the late summer, and the generals were aware of that. And his unwillingness to accept reality there led to the disaster. So dealing with the German economy in the 1930s, there is this a sense that there's a German revival. Resurgence by the mid-1930s. So some people have commented on that success. Was there anything good that you could cite about the German economy? that could be used as an example or worthy of some of the praise that it's gotten by revisionists?
Much has been made out of the German motto that's hung over the slave labor camp of Auschwitz, which, by the way, was a death camp due to the typhus that raged there. But you're familiar with the motto, Arbeit macht frei, work makes you free. And that is a German virtue, their work ethic. We see in the ashes of World War II how quickly they rebuilt their nation, as did the people I like to call the Germans of the East, the Japanese, the work type of post-war miraculous recovery, presumably with the help of Almighty God. So yes, the German work ethic was saddled on a war economy. I mean, you see the same thing. There are parallels between Hitler and Roosevelt, because the United States was never out of the Depression until Roosevelt engineered us into the Second World War, and then the munition factories were humming and we had nearly full employment. And Hitler began on that war path early in his march to power in the early 1930s. And so if that's a successful economy, when you put it on a war economy, I guess you could call it successful. But the idea that we're going to judge the state of Germany from the newsreel footage, which all comes from, the majority of it comes from Nazi newsreel producers, showing mesmerized people Sieg Heiling and giving the Nazi salute and everyone eager for war or eager at least for the suzerainty of the Nazi Party and the leadership or the Führerprinzip of Adolf Hitler. I think that's a gross distortion of how the German people felt. If you look at the letters early on that troops received on the Eastern Front, and this is after the German army had conquered most of Europe, North Africa, and if you look at and that's prima facie evidence when you're looking at letters and correspondence from parents to the youth who were on the Russian front, and then vice versa, and you're seeing the tremendous sense of foreboding. And even outright fear that they had for the type of ambitions that Hitler had. Now, they couldn't state in the letter that they were reckless, but they certainly spoke around that without, you know, possibly being arrested for unpatriotic statements in wartime. So I don't think the German people were as happy as the footage tends to show. And I believe that I am not happy with the American economy, and I wouldn't have been happy with it in the supposed halcyon days of the 1950s, in the post-war boom then, because it was a usury-based economy. And what that means is that it's predicated, as Hitler's Germany was, on a certain portion of the population being in debt peonage. Now, besides the Bible, both in the New Testament and the Old reserving the condemnation of usury for those who practice it among Israelites, and then in the New, outlawing it for everyone. But when we look at that, we look at that type, those prohibitions against usury, we also see another one, and that is the limitation on any debt beyond 7 years. And that is another thing which the churches today and the churches then paid little attention to. And so if all loans come due at the end of 7 years, then you're freeing people from debt peonage at the end of that. All those things are overlooked in American society, except for the fact that our bankruptcy laws still have that number 7 in them to a certain limited degree. But these are largely overlooked. So God does not want his people in peonage of any kind. Jesus came to free us, not to rebind us under man's laws and governance. So perhaps I'm too much of a purist, but I would not say that any usury economy, be it National Socialist Germany's or the American capitalist one, is anything to be proud of. And I can anticipate my critics again saying that this American economy has lifted more people out of poverty than any other economy. Again, an extreme generalization in terms of how much going against God's law does in terms of enervating the soul and the spirit of men and women. And that's a subject for another day. But so that would be my judgment on the economy at that time.
Yeah, it's hard to assess the Nazi Germany's economy, because they're only in power for 12 years, and 6 of those years she was at war, and that distorts the economy and all calculation. And obviously, in the final analysis, it didn't fare too well, the German economy, because it was crushed under the weight of Allied bombs and the Red Army. But you're right. I mean, it's there's a question of sustainability in any economy with usury, because you have compound interest. And I think I've heard you comment in another interview. You said that even if you're Henry Ford or Thomas Edison, you can't compete with the miracle of compound interest. And inevitably, it weights everyone down and brings about slavery in one form or another. And we're seeing that today, of course.
That's why we're ruled by the money power. Until we stop the renting of money, no one, whether they're the best inventor, the finest farmer, the smartest manufacturer, can exceed the profits that the hedge funds and other ancillary economic instruments that spin off of that compound interest create in our society. And all I see is symptomatic band-aid approaches to this when people talk about fighting the money power. And I don't see a return to the root, which is the medieval Catholic theology on this subject, which also, for our Protestant friends who are listening, is also thoroughly and completely biblical.
And regarding the war itself, if you look at the up until 1941, Hitler had seemed to sort of achieve these short Bismarckian style victories, whether it's regaining Poland or attack going west. People forget that England and France declared war on Germany, so technically that wasn't really aggression. Of course, you can talk about the Low Countries and Norway, but in that case, he was beating the Allies to the punch. But these short wars.
He did promise that after Czechoslovakia, he wouldn't take any more land. And Chamberlain gave the guarantee to Poland at that time. Hitler's antenna should have pricked right up at that point. When Chamberlain gave that guarantee that England would go to war if Hitler gobbled up any more of the East. And then he broke his word to Great Britain, and he did attack Poland. And that's
the blank check. But I'm saying, strictly speaking, England wasn't in a position to alter what was going on in Eastern Europe, and nor was it a justification for her to declare a general war. Was England historically a defender of small nations? Ask the Irish.
But on the other hand, I mean, in this era, there was a sense, of course, there undoubtedly ulterior motives are at work here. I don't doubt that. But there was in England, and again, relying on Patrick J. Buchanan, who's not exactly a softie on this subject, there was an awareness in Great Britain of the formidable military power that Germany represented. But there was also a fear that there was no stopping Hitler in terms of his aggrandizement. Now, I happen to believe that he would have not turned toward the West. I happen to believe he had a tremendous admiration for the British and the British Empire. But what he forgot was, in his folly or madness or occultism, was that by taking Poland, the English were not going to be intimidated, because the one ace they had up their sleeve was their air force, which, and I grant you, in 1939, there were virtually no Spitfires and so forth. But the ability to raise that air force and the quality of airmen that they had, the RAF did a great deal of damage to Germany even before the American Expeditionary Air Force came in, Armed Air Force came in after 1941. So these should have all been issues in Hitler's mind, and he overlooked them. There was no roof over the Reich when the RAF came pouring in. And then, of course, when the Mustangs came in, this is even prior to the invasion of Russia. So it's a mess to me, but go ahead with your thesis suggesting that, you're not saying that Hitler did nothing wrong, but that it was understandable that he would take the East and the English unnecessarily attacked. Is that it?
Well, I mean, given the map of Europe, I mean, you could Poland and the Polish independence was less than 20 years. It was carved out of the German and Russian Empire, and its existence, its independence, was based on a dual German and Russian defeat in the First World War, which was an odd occurrence, but it was brought about by the Bolshevik Revolution, which was funded by the West. So but you're dealing with intrigues, and at least at the meta level, these things are being manipulated, I think, that go beyond even Hitler's pay grade. And Churchill, these statesmen or these leaders are agents of a higher power.
Sure.
You know, and that's the meta level of these things. And that's what you got the First World War and the Second World War, which I think is kind of a second 30 years war to gain control of the continent and therefore the world, the pivot of the world, which is the Eurasian landmass. And but my point is that this invasion of Russia, I mean, this megalomaniacal desire to control the East, was this an attempt to break out of German strategic dilemma that became clear because of the hunger blockade, the First World War? This fed the doctrine of Lebensraum, the Mackinder Doctrine. It was a dialectic going on there. But nevertheless, you cite in your book is even when the war was going well for the Wehrmacht in the East, she was suffering huge casualties. You're talking like 500,000 dead by the end of the summer. I mean, there's simply no way Germany could sustain that.
180,000 German kids were dead within 3 months. So that's more than Vietnam and Korea, and then another 55,000. You could say, well, actually 80,000 right there. But I guess that didn't matter that much to Hitler. You know, 180,000 of these kids. But, you know, as Mr. Kelly, as early as 1922, he was already planning an attack on Russia as well as colonizing the East. There's a secret conversation that he had with the financier Edward Scharrer, who was an heir of the Anheuser-Busch beer fortune through marriage and co-owner of a big newspaper in Germany, Scharrer. Mm-hmm. And Hitler stated that Germany should aim for the destruction of Russia with the aid of England. And this actually comes from David Irving. He found the memo, and Irving titles it, "Hitler sets out his secret plans to a wealthy donor in December 1922. And so this is catastrophic for, at that time, you know, Germany was a crippled country, crippled by the Versailles Treaty. And here you can see Hitler's long-range plans for doing in Russia. I think that to unnecessarily take on Stalin's empire like that, but it's based on the underestimate of the Slavs as being a slave-like people, that the Germans would be able, in fact, Hitler gambled that they would be in Moscow by December of 1941. And again, the people who are his panegyrists say that the Austere fought to the gates of Moscow. Well, I didn't see Hitler in their ranks if they fought to the gates of Moscow, and I don't think they got any closer than 30 or 35 miles. It was due to the fortitude of the frontline German soldier and their brilliant commanders. And by the way, if you look at the diaries of the German commanders at that time, they said, "We couldn't have gone another mile. We were out of gas. We were out of engines. We were out of tanks. And we were out of ammunition." So the notion that just Hitler turning, and I believe this at one time, just turning towards Stalingrad, that's the legend that some of his generals to exculpate themselves planted later on. But they had been fought to a standstill by the subhuman so-called Red Army, when in fact the Red Army's performance there under unbelievable conditions, because as you know, the Soviet secret police, the NKVD, shot them down if they even attempted to retreat. Then if they were taken prisoner by the Germans, they would be executed or sent to Siberia at the end of the war. It was a horrible situation, and I really have sympathy for the frontline Russian soldier. I'm aware of the mass rapes in Germany, Ilya Ehrenberg's propaganda, which instigated much of that. But nonetheless, these conscripted Russian kids who did not want to fight the Germans, but they were forced to do so. And then, of course, when Germany invaded, they were keen to do so because they had a patriotic sense of their land. You have to understand Russian Orthodoxy, which does not have a division between the church and the monarch, and probably to some degree they associated Stalin with the Tsar. But anyhow, yes, it's a dreadful thing that happened, and it sealed the fate of Germany and the German people, and that's why I say that Hitler was the enemy of the German people.
So, I mean, with Hitler, I have a few more minutes left here. With Adolf Hitler, he comes to power, and he achieves the objectives of the cryptocracy.
Well, he's the original $6 million man for the Israeli state. I mean, they would have not been able to found their Israeli state, which was all on the sympathy that the Judaic people earned, having been slaughtered in the hundreds of thousands, if not more than that, during World War II. Mm-hmm. Then as a result of Hitler's regime. And that's how the Palestinian land was stolen and the Israeli project was imposed. So this is certainly a tremendous benefit to the Zionist powerhouse that cared nothing for individual Judaic people. There were many opportunities they had to save Judaic people from the Nazis. And as you probably know, there's internal memos and other evidence that they thought it would be good that they were killed by the Nazis, because that would create more of a groundswell of support for the Israeli regime and occupied Palestine.
Yeah, the Zionism itself, I guess, goes back to with Theodor Herzl, and that's the turn of the late 19th century. But they've been working on this for decades. And of course, the you have the Balfour Declaration, written to Lord Rothschild in 1917. But it was really the catastrophe of the Second World War, and also the narrative that came out of that war with the Holocaust, that gave allowed for the birth of Israel as a state.
And if Hitler had never come to power, or someone like him, whether it was a Goebbels or a Hitler, I don't see how you would have had an Israeli state there in the Middle East. And as you say, the roots are back in World War I with the fall of the Ottoman Empire, because if that was still Ottoman territory, then Balfour and the English would have had to fight another war with Turkey. But as a result of the defeat and breakup of the Ottoman Empire, then Britain was able to move in, Masonic Britain was able to move in and create that foothold for the Zionists, contrary to what the Talmud had taught the Judaic people. And as you know, there's still a minority of the Hasidic Judaics and even non-Hasidic Orthodox Judaics who follow the Talmudic lead, which is that there is not to be any land for a government of Israel on earth until the Messiah comes, or until the Moshiach comes. And so there is a substantial minority of Hasidim who are not just the Nutari Karta who went to the Iranian Holocaust Conference, but many tens of thousands more, hundreds of thousands more, the Satmar, for example, who don't believe that the Israeli state has any legitimacy whatsoever. And that's based on the Talmud, because the Talmud had always advised that they befriend the Gentile rulers of the nation in which they were resident. And the history of Europe is testimony to that, and then derive protection from the peasants and the working class from the ruling class. And that's the beginning of the partnership between Talmudism and the Gentile ruling class in Europe and Great Britain.
I guess a sort of a Talmudry or a Talmudic interpretation of the Talmud, twisting it around.
It's situation ethics, though. That's the essence of it. So there are certain non-negotiable axioms there. The Judaic male is the embodiment of God and things like that. But much else is open, depending on the zeitgeist and depending on the spirit of the times. And that's why I was so crestfallen in researching my book, Occult Renaissance Church of Rome, when I saw the degree to which situation ethics through the papacy's embrace of the Talmud and Kabbalah had led to the derogation of the laws against the renting of money. And so situation ethics entered the church during the Renaissance, when the secret gnosis, both Kabbalistic and Talmudic in many respects, had seized the papacy, beginning with Alexander VI. And there are a few notable exceptions there. But again, that's a topic for another time.
That's what the thought that I had that I had forgotten was, you make the point in the book, and this we can close out the interview because I want to be respectful of your time, is you point out that by appealing to the protocols, the Elders of Zion, as opposed to valid research regarding Talmud and the problem with the Jews, that the Hitler and people like Ford had relied on a document which had no basis or scholarship to it, which then sets it up to be criticized at the way it is today, when there's much better research and documents to cite regarding Jewish behavior, Jewish involvement in Europe and its history. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yes, I'd be glad to, because that's a very, very important point. I don't want to get into debating whether or not the protocols were faked by the Russian Secret Service or whether they're authentic per se. But what I will say, and I think that's indisputable, is that they're disputed. and they're highly disputed. And so why would Adolf Hitler, who promoted them throughout his career, the protocols, and his circle of advisors — Hitler wasn't the best educated man in the world, maybe he would have admitted that, maybe he would have had a moment of humility there, but certainly many of his advisors were very well educated, and they were therefore aware of the great German Lutheran Hebraist, Johann Andreas Eisenmenger, who in 1700 wrote a two-volume, 2,000-page Meisterstück, masterwork, called Entdecktes Judentum, or Judaism Discovered. I also wrote a book with that title as a way of honoring Eisenmenger, who, by the way, was not a Jew hater by any means. Like me, he was attempting to liberate Judaic people and all people from the micromanagement and occultism and anti-Christianity of the Talmud. Well, here was 2,000 pages of irrefutable documentation. Hitler had the money, the printing presses, to be able to take that book, do a modern edition, translate it into English, Spanish, many other languages. That really would have put a huge dent in the reputation of Judaism in a remarkable and powerful way. And instead, it was totally ignored, left in obscurity to gather dust. And meanwhile, Hitler even allowed for, and I have one volume of it, he allowed for the publication of a fairly unexpurgated, not completely uncensored, but fairly unexpurgated edition of the Talmud that was published in Nazi Germany when they were in full control of the printing presses there. So Eisenmenger gets neglected, the Talmud is circulating, and this highly disputed protocols that no one can actually prove to the benefit of anyone outside the right-wing hothouse, that fever swamp, that this is actually authentic. Why would you do that? Why would you overlook such a golden opportunity? I suppose someone could say, in Hitler's defense, that everyone makes mistakes and that was it. But this, to me, seems like on the level of a cosmic blunder. We ourselves came out with a PDF version of the Eisenmenger work. We bought the book, two-volume set, at great expense, because the Holy Roman Emperor had been suborned by his Judaic financiers into banning the book. And so there were very few copies of the first edition extant. There was a second edition published, but it's not reliable. It's mostly reliable, but not entirely. So we bought it. We scanned it on PDF for German readers. But in English, there's only an excerpt by a French Huguenot exile in Great Britain who published excerpts in the 18th century, and that's still locked up in that old antiquarian typesetting. We reprinted that, too. We'd certainly love to see somebody take over translating that. It's in the public domain, of course, and it remains to this day the inaugural scientific exposition of Talmudism in a loving and kind and decent way, but also with brilliant linguistic ability, because Eisenmenger studied with rabbis in Amsterdam. He mastered the Aramaic and Hebrew. Most of the Talmud, of course, is written in Aramaic, not Hebrew, but he mastered those languages, and Hitler ignored the whole thing. To me, it's another nail in the coffin of the National Socialist Project. Other people may make of it what they will.
Now, okay, well...
No, go ahead. We're over schedule, but you're a good interviewer. We can run for the next however many, 3 or 4 or 5 minutes is fine.
Oh, okay. Now, this book, I suspect you got a lot of criticism for this book from revisionist corners. And now, what is your take? I mean, the purpose of revisionism is to sort of unravel, you know, the half-truths, the lies, and the official narratives that we receive, retailed to us as history. What's your take on what's the mission of revisionism? I think you've spoken on this before. What is your objective here?
Well, revisionism is an epistemology. In other words, it's a theory of knowledge, and it's not beholden to rehabilitating the reputation of Adolf Hitler or any particular goal inside of history. As an epistemology, what it's trying to do is say that at any given point in time, new information is always coming forward. And knowledge is not power. It is the ability to detect fraud that is power. And therefore, taking that realization and revisioning history on the basis of whatever we're finding in someone's attic, what's ever being unearthed in a tomb, what's ever being re-looked at that we thought we had seen the first time, but now a second look reveals more, that this should be taken in and resulting in a modification of our view at any given time of every ideology and every chronicle of history. And what's happened is that I would say in half the cases, revisionists, including World War II revisionists, and I can think of some names, I won't mention them, they have remained loyal to that epistemological project and to their credit. And there's been some wonderful work done. And it's very courageous, too, because they're subject to enormous persecution. But at the same time, there are people who are very little more than if, okay, I guess I could use the word Hitler enthusiast, but that's almost a euphemism for borderline neo-Nazi in some cases. And they have a religious passion for rehabilitating Hitler, and revisionism is not really the goal. It's a vehicle that they use to hide behind while they're promoting the rehabilitation of this man, which I think is very destructive for our people when you look at the alt-right and people who are ignorant of Hitler's actual record and what he did to the German people and are in the mood to rehabilitate that one-person dictator again. And I think that would be to the delight of our enemies to see us once again eschew the model, the successful model of the American Revolution, where George Washington refused the crown and went for limited government. He could have been military dictator of America, and he refused that. And people like Jefferson and others created a republic whereby limited government was at the core of that. Whereas Hitler had this messianic model, very similar to what Judaism represents. And I really fear that this is taking over in the alt-right movement. And I hope that my book would be some kind of a moderating influence. Unfortunately, the attacks have been almost unprecedented. I faced other attacks from Catholics for some of my positions about the papacy and the Renaissance and post-Renaissance. But these are even more intense, and it's actually caused a loss to us in many ways. I was hoping to expand this book. I have a great deal more material. This was actually going to be kind of a groundwork for a discussion such as you have afforded me here today, but that mostly hasn't happened. I was invited onto a program that some neo-Nazis inspired, and I want to be kind here, but the mediocre level of their discourse, it was so poor that I felt that even appearing there would not be helpful at all, because I had read some of their critiques and it was just silly regurgitations of Nazi propaganda. And, you know, people have to have some degree of objectivity in order to engage with them. So anyhow, there hasn't been a real discourse on the subject, and I hope that there would be, because there's a lot more to be said and a lot more to be studied. And let's stay faithful to the original revisionist mission, which is that we follow the truth wherever it leads.
Yes, that's because the truth, as they say, the truth shall set us free. That's the objective of this. I'm just know that even I think you make the point in the book that Alfred Rosenberg has some kind of things to say about Talmudism, or at least the approach. And even I think Reinhard Heydrich had some kind of things to say about Zionism. And that's an odd, you know, pairing, if you will, at least intellectual pairing. But it you can understand it if you read your book, understand how this sort of descent into Talmudism is sort of this controlled opposition where you're manipulated into becoming your enemy to serve your enemy. And that's, that's kind of what they did when you had this sort of mystification of race superiority, which is now the world is told we have to fight white supremacy. And there's, of course, the Germanic supremacy of the Aryan that the Nazis promoted. But we don't talk about the Jewish supremacy that's in the Talmud, which is very problematic. So.
Yeah, the rabbinic supremacy, which is certainly real, and there's no question about it. I wrote two books about it, but also mirrored in the Nazis' notion of the self-worship of the Germans. And that's a clear reflection, at least in my opinion, of Talmudic dogma.
Yeah, and it's fundamentally anti-Christian, as you say.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, well, listen, I've had you more than I said I would, so I want to, I want to be respectful of your time. I want to thank you for coming on the show.
I thank you for having me, Mr. Gilley.
And that's Adolf Hitler, Enemy of the German People. It's you can still get it at Amazon, right?
A couple of my books have been banned there. That one has not. And I suppose there'll be a conspiracy theory saying, well, Hoffman's gone over to the other side. But the ADL is on my trail, and they've taken us off YouTube, and they continue to try and cancel us in general online. So people who imagine that really don't know what they're talking about.
And they can go to your website, which is revisionisthistory.org.
Revisionisthistory.org. That's it. Yes.
Okay, well, thanks. I'm going to wish you a good night then. I'll post this soon. When I do, I'll send you the link.
Thank you.
And you can post it and, you know, put it out however you wish. We'll go from there. Well, thanks a lot. Good night then. And sometime in the near future, you can come back on, discuss some other aspect of your research.
Certainly.
Thank you so much then. Good night then.
Good night.
Bye-bye.